Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztraber. On today's show, online education. The internet has revolutionized our world in so many ways, giving people access to more information than ever before and making it easier to communicate with more people than ever before. But has the internet really changed education, or are we still seeing essentially the same old system, whether it's public schools or private schools, with an instructor in the classroom and a report card and SATs and all that? But is education ripe for disruption, and can technology be that disruptor? Joining me to discuss this is Jan Hein Hoogstad. I hope I didn't butcher that too badly. He's the founder and technology developer for Off Course. This is an online education platform, and you can check it out at offcourse.io. That's offcourse.io. Jan, thanks for joining.
Hey, great to be here.
So before we jump into the topic of online education and what it means for policy, tell me about Off Course. What does your platform do?
So Off Course is a tool for everyone that wants to learn. And we would say we specialize or we focus on people that do either or both, probably just-in-time learning and lifelong learning. And that means that we realize that there's a lot of people nowadays that learn all the time. You know, it's not no longer like in the old days that you learned in school and then you knew something and you were an expert and you went on to, I think in the old days it was an abstraction or it was a lie as well, but nowadays we're much more aware of it. So basically what Off Course does is it facilitates people that want to learn on their own and that want to learn new things. And we do that by simply using what's already there. And that's a lot of learning material on the internet. And we provide a very simple, but in my opinion, efficient abstraction to share those links, to share those resources, to structure them, and to make sure that you know where how to go from A to Z, know where to start, know what's good, what is bad, work on curricula, share them. So if I had to say it in like two words, I would say it's an online syllabus, but an interactive, crowdsourced, and collaborative syllabus. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, it does, of course. And of course, right? Now, we're gonna have that pun throughout the show, I'm sure.
I know.
And people will love that. So you're based in the Netherlands, right? But of course, this platform is open to anyone with an internet connection.
Yeah, of course. And I think I have to watch myself as well saying that word not too many times. it's open to everyone with an internet connection. And that's actually one of our aims. We strive to be a global platform, and also and not only for people that have very, very high-tech, high-speed internet connections, but actually also slower connections, older connections. It's a platform, and it's an online site, and it's a modern or whatever kind of site. But it's also an interface and a way of sharing information, and that could also happen in on much lower connections, and it doesn't always need high-speed video or very, very graphic-rich interactions. It could be just as simple as a text file.
So when people think about learning online, their experience might be very simple. It might be just going to Wikipedia to look something up, or it might be just Googling it and then doing some basic research. But as much as the internet has given access to so much information, that might be a problem in and of itself, too much information. And we have this joke in the US where when someone says they found something online, you respond, oh, well, if you saw it on the internet, then it must be true because it's so hard to tell, right? And we have sites like Snopes and PolitiFact and others that try to sort through the facts and the fiction. How does Off Course gather data? Are you getting data from government sites? Are there open source platforms? I'm just trying to get a sense of what are these data that allow you to provide education to people all over the world online, and how do you make sure that information is accurate?
These are a lot of questions packed into one, so if I forget something, let me know. But to start with, everything, we don't provide content ourselves. We provide a structure around the content, and that means that everything that you can reach with a link can be included in our platform. So as long as there's an internet link and URL, we can do something about it. One of the things that we do is we analyze the data that comes in. So whether that's a website or a video, we see what kind of metadata we can get out of it, and so on and so forth. That data that are so we use the fact that the internet is already open. That might be a surprise to a lot of people, but there is a lot of like data that is available without going through a paywall or without going through Facebook's Graph API or whatever you want to do. So that's one thing. And then the second part that we use is the interaction that people have with the content. So that means the fact that you go to a certain website, that you link to a certain resource where you want to learn. This is also data, and if you use it properly, you can do a lot of things with it. The other part about your question, how do you verify? Well, there are a couple of ways. Verification and false news and everything that we talk about nowadays, it's a difficult question. I think there's a scope of interventions that we make there. First of all, just the fact that someone learns through this resource is a data point. It might be a very small data point, but it's very interesting nonetheless. But one of the options that we give people is to say, well, you suggest to me that you should learn it this way. You should you say that this resource, this blog post, this video is very interesting, but I know a better one. And then you get into a form of verification because someone says, okay, I think this is better than this one. And so that's richer data than the original data point. It's not only I use this to learn this, but it also means like I saw both and I compared them and I said the other one is better.
Right.
So
there's an element of crowd sourcing and user interaction that we've seen with other internet platforms, like with online reviews and the ability to flag certain content. So you're essentially relying on your user base to an extent to help improve the syllabus.
Exactly. But the difference, for instance, with Wikipedia is in Wikipedia land, there always has to be one truth. So you see a lot of wars on Wikipedia for like authorities or non-authorities fighting over the same Wikipedia article. So one day it's...
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Hey, but you know how it goes. One day Putin is a dictator, the other time he's not. And every day they go back and forth. If you look at visualization, data visualizations of Wikipedia, you can sometimes really see them like visually that they alternate like every day. And it's just a back and forth between one word or one thing that people want to hide and other people want to show and one people accept as fact. And the other. We don't do that. We just say like, no, these different interpretations can stand next to each other. And it's more or less, it's a distributed system. So I make a list. Yeah, and some people may say that I'm smart and they want to follow the list. Other people would say like, well, I don't accept him as an authority. But he has some interesting points, so I take his list, I make a variation on it. And these two truths can stand next to each other. And then out of the data and out of the user adoption, they're basically just letting this system evolve, you get a sense of what is better and what is worse. And also, in the case of whether or not something is true or false, and that's a difficult question, but in a way, it's an easy distinction. Something either is true or it's false. But in the case of learning, because we specifically talk about a learning platform here and not just an information platform,
right?
Things are often not that easy. The fact that I learned something better through a certain article or a certain blog post doesn't mean you do too. So it's very important that these truths can stand next to each other because it's not AI or truth, but these different ways of learning and these different ways of experiencing this information or this knowledge can stand next to each other. Because in the case of learning, learning is not just factual. Learning is also a routine. It's a practice. It's something you do and not only information that you consume. And there's a difference, I would say. Does that make sense?
Yes. So online education does have so much potential. And that's often what we talk about with online education because it's hard to really tell where we're at now. But recently, I hosted I moderated a panel at the Internet Governance Forum here in DC. And we talked about the digital dividends from the internet, whether it was economic dividends, like being able to use the sharing economy, or whether it was an educational dividend, a healthcare dividend. And we really talked about all the predictions that were made, you know, 20 years ago by people like Bill Gates, right? And whether these things have come to pass. And there was some discussion on the panel that it's just very early to be delivering a verdict on online education. But if we look at your platform, you know, there's some practical things that might happen here, like democratization of education, right? Basically the ability to say, whatever your station in life or whatever your circumstances are, having an internet connection can help you remove that barrier to access. But then when we get to tech policy and we think about the way that government views education, the relationship between government and education, is that a major barrier here? That essentially your platform is not an accredited university. It's not somewhere where someone can get a bachelor's degree, and then that might make it harder for them to leverage that education. Is that something you found that in developing your platform, you're running up against the old system?
I hope not. That's, I think, the best answer I can give. Of course, there are people that say that. In a way, I mean, it's we have to be realistic in every case. I mean, it's still the way education works. It's a currency. It's much more often, I'm exaggerating here deliberately, but it's often more about membership than it's actually about skills and about knowledge.
No, it's a fair point. I mean, people often argue that the return on investment, especially in the United States, where education is often very expensive, and I know there are countries all over the world where it's included in your tax bill, but there are often people who say, look, it's really just about the name, so that you can walk into an office and have an interview and say that you went to that university, but there's very little measurement of your actual skills. I mean, is that something that your platform is addressing, this issue Yep. of, did I actually learn? Are these actually applicable skills, or did I just do the four-year degree just to do it? Because it's basically like a college degree in the United States is now like a high school degree 30, 40 years ago. You basically have to have one if you want to get a job that has any skill requirement.
Yeah, here's the same. I would say there's... can I make a little bit of a detour? Because I find I need a couple of sentences extra in order to do your question justice. So I would say... first of all, before I go into our alternative, first of all, the question is how much do we validate the worth of an education nowadays? Right. How do we know what a diploma is actually worth? How do we know that that candidate that did a certain school or has a certain diploma actually has the knowledge? And I would say we have very little data points, incredibly little data points when we compare it to much less critical tasks in our lives. To give an example, if you have a nest in your home or something like that, you know more about, you have more data points about the day, the temperature in your house throughout the day than about what you've learned throughout your life.
Yeah, this the nest, for those who don't know, just to quickly explain, the Google Nest is a smart thermometer that ostensibly helps you save money by changing the temperature while you're not in your home.
Yeah, so in the best case in education, we have... we know when you started a certain kind of education. We know what courses you took. We know what grades you had. Sometimes there are in-between grades, but it's very, very sparse information. It's not very dense. I mean, from a data perspective, it's actually, it's almost negligible. So the question basically is, okay, how much is expertise worth and what? How do we do it? I think there are two futures that we can bet on. We can... bet on a future that accepts that part. And we say, like, okay, that's just the way it is. It's an investment. Some people can afford it, so others cannot. That's not the future that I want to, and we want to bet on. The future that we see is that it's in everyone's interest that there's actually a better fit between what you know and the work that you do. And I think if you had some... experience with hiring people, recruiting people, you know that this is an actual problem. It's basically the fact that we don't have enough learning points, or we don't have enough data points about what people know, what they are, how they work, all these kinds of things is a problem, because it takes a lot of money to actually find the right people for the right jobs. And then even then, more often than not, you find out when you actually work with these people that they might not be the fit, or they're not enough, or whatever. So I think getting more data about this is not just an ideological problem, it's a real problem also in economic terms.
Yeah, and we see this in the United States a bit with the companies in Silicon Valley saying, look, we keep trying to find the people to fill these positions and we can't. And that also feeds into the immigration debate, where companies on one hand are saying, look, if we can't find the talent domestically, we have to go international. But then that also raises the question of why are people in any particular country not able to fill the jobs? And we talk about STEM education, science, technology, math, that kind of stuff. And companies are saying they're spending a lot of money going to colleges to recruit. A lot of times they're getting criticized for going to the same schools over and over again and not really broadening to more marginalized communities in the United States, whether that's rural America or low-income urban areas. They keep going to the Ivy League schools and the schools with well-known tech programs. Now, of course, online education could provide an alternative to training people and getting them ready for these jobs. But doesn't this require a cultural shift in the way that companies view hiring? Would they have to really make a deliberate decision to say, we're no longer just going to rely on the same old measurements over and over and over again? The measurements that you've suggested are just inadequate. Are they going to embrace things like your platform as a way of measuring talent and skills?
In a way, I would say they already do, and especially in the tech industry. I think if you look at the numbers, 69% of the professional developers, so coders, doesn't come from a traditional education. So it's either self-taught or went on through other programs. So that's kind of like some indicator for us, and also some future that we bet on, as I said before, that things might change and shift in that direction. That actually finding the right people becomes less and less. To go back to the STEM part and stuff, it might be interesting to say how I actually came to this approach and this platform and where it comes from, because I wasn't always an entrepreneur. I actually taught at a university, the University of Amsterdam and Utrecht before that, and Berlin, but I was in universities for almost 20 years. And one of the things that I noticed in 2013, I was in San Francisco for a while as a developer, and when I came back to Amsterdam, I noticed that there's actually a strange thing going on. On the one hand, you have people, in the States, we also have this focus on STEM and stuff. On the other hand, I see a lot of programmers, professional developers, going through boot camps and all these kinds of things that come from a humanities or a liberal arts background. And they're actually really good coders. But we still have this stigma that in order to develop or in order to code, you need a technical background, or you need like a STEM education.
Yeah, whereas a computer science degree from somewhere. Yeah,
but whereas it's actually programming is a lot. It's a linguistic. It's a language skill. It's working with languages. So one of the things I did there was I went to the dean and I said like, hey, why don't we teach coding courses here? Because I see, on the one hand, I see a problem with people not finding jobs after they graduate. On the other hand, I see enormous demand for people who actually want to program and want to would like to do this and learn this and stuff. So we started this program called Coding the Humanities at the University of Amsterdam and the Free University and one other school in Amsterdam, and we did it for a year. But then we said, but we now just do, and this was basically a bootcamp style course. But then we had like 16 students and we were like, okay, but how can we scale this? How can we scale this approach? Yeah, because that's the problem I have with the bootcamp model. It's expensive and it takes a lot of time. And again, it provides a certain kind of elitism. It needs to. Yeah? You need to have a small group that does it. It needs to, because you want a high intensity, high maintenance kind of education. So we focused on the online part, not to replace the offline part or the physical part, but just in order to see like, okay, what kind of interventions can we make there? And then we realized like, hey, this approach is not only applicable to coding or technical skills, but it's also applicable to a lot of other things. And actually we don't use those online possibilities enough at the moment. We see like the solutions there, most of them mimic the traditional classroom setting. And one of the things that we would like to change, or that I thought was really interesting to see how we could play with that, is basically saying like, okay, what is the role of the expert? And then I come to your question: and is an expert that important? Does one person need to be the expert, or is it much better to say like, hey, we can all learn from each other? And that's like actually the sentiment that we want to facilitate. But you're right, it needs a cultural change, and it's not something that will happen overnight.
So getting back to subject matter, it might depend on the subject whether online education can be a substitute, a complement, or how it works, right? So for STEM fields, it seems very, very obvious that online education can at least be a complement, if not a substitute for traditional education, because it's so technical and because you need to be interacting with computers. But just anecdotally, my sister is an English teacher and she's young. She's no Luddite, but she's very frustrated with the attempts to implement technology in her English class because it's clumsy. It's not well thought out, for one. And she just thinks, look, I'm teaching a book. I'm trying to get these kids to debate complex topics like America's history of racial problems or gender inequality. And I don't need them futzing around on their phones and their laptops and their tablets. That basically adds nothing and it just detracts. Does online education lend itself better to certain topics over others? Or would you say that it's potentially beneficial in any instance? It just, the implementation is what matters, not just the fact that it's online.
The second, definitely. And I can elaborate a little bit on that. I also don't come from a technical background in my teaching. Even though I've been coding my entire life, I was a professor in literature and philosophy. So I'm also from a humanities background in my teaching. And I think I agree with your sister completely, by the way. I mean, people often force technologies into places where they don't benefit, and they don't use it in places where they would benefit. So that's why I also say we don't provide an online solution to education in the sense that it replaces everything. We use it in order to facilitate a different style of learning, which is something completely different. And in that case that you just described, I would say, for instance, something I did a lot in my classes, which is very similar to the platform in the end, is I started my courses with literature that I suggested the first 3 weeks. And then after 3 weeks, I said to the students, okay, for the fourth week, I want you to make your own syllabus for that week about this topic. So go and do the research, find resources. You can get them wherever. I don't mind. I don't have any bias towards any kind of medium or any kind of text. But just come up with a couple of things that we should read or watch or whatever. And then either I decided which students list we took, or I made a mix out of it, or I let them vote. But that was basically the way we structured the sessions afterwards. So that was actually using, and of course there's nothing else, it's very similar in its approach to that, was nothing else but facilitating actually these discussions that your sister so desperately wants. And we use the technology to facilitate the classroom sessions by basically saying, so you don't have to use the technology in the classroom itself. Actually, I didn't use it at that point. I just used it in order to prepare those sessions and to have like a better way of having the students engage with the material. So it's really thinking about where do you make the intervention. And I think that in most cases, that's actually not in the actual sessions. I think that's in most cases actually what the students do. These other, how many hours are there in the week? All these other hours in the week that there are not in the classroom. Because that's when you want them to further explore, deepen themselves, learn. That's why we focus so much also on just-in-time and lifelong learning. By making learning should be a habit, something that you do automatically and not something that you just do when you go to the classroom. Does that make, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah. And in speaking to you both in this conversation and a previous conversation we had that was not being recorded, I've gotten the sense from you that you're not necessarily trying to fit your platform or online education into the traditional education system. You're not necessarily trying to change the accreditation system so that people using OffCourse get the same credentials as people who attend a university. But that said, there might be still some lessons for policymakers in this conversation. So all over the world, we're seeing a backlash to automation, automation, technological disruption, globalization. And many of the narratives, however true or untrue they may be, that come out of these discussions is that there are parts of the world that are just left behind, whether they don't have broadband or there are just not enough economic opportunities in these areas, and wealth and jobs are being concentrated in wealthy urban areas. That said, policymakers are, you know, alert to this issue. They are trying to fix it. We talk about building more broadband, having government make sure that the most rural parts of your country are connected. We talk about pouring money into STEM education. We talk about community colleges. given your experience in education, both on and offline, if you had a message, and it could be multiple messages for policymakers, not just in the United States or in the Netherlands, but all over the world, who want to tackle this problem, who want to prepare their citizens for high-tech jobs, what would you say? Is it changing the accreditation? Is it putting more money in broadband or something else?
It's actually something completely different. I think the most important part is that we all should be able to give up our status of being an expert and expecting to be an expert. I think that's the real underlying problem. The idea, and then the policy part has to do with the fact of even if you look at, and I don't say this to trash them or whatever, but I just say that if you look at edX or Coursera, they say we're democratizing education because people in India can now, or Africa, can now get our high-class education. And there's already such a paternalistic, almost, like, tone in that, because we have high-class education and we're now sharing it with you. It's not, okay, it's only the question, what can you learn from us? It's not what can you learn, what can we learn from you? And I would say that's also what I find so interesting about education, and also what made me stop being a teacher myself. The moment that I realized that we were a group of 25 students and one teacher, and the moment I realized what a waste of resources that is, a tremendous waste of resources, because we're losing 25 potential teachers there, you know, 25 people that I could learn from. And that doesn't mean always simultaneously. That doesn't mean there cannot be any roles, or there cannot be any distribution of power or any distribution of knowledge. But it does mean, I think we are very, very, and policymakers are so much focused on that, on the expert at the moment. You know, the TED Talks and the politicians that want to show that they also know something, and actors that actually say that they know so much about politics nowadays. Everyone is an expert.
Preach to the choir, man.
Yeah, okay, cool. But mostly, like, I think it starts with, how do you say it, a genuine interest to learn from other people. I think that's where education should go from, and policy should stem from there. You know, like, yeah, of course, we can bring high-speed internet everywhere. But again, whose interest is that in? Eh? And often, is that because then we can broadcast all those videos to Africa? Eh? So is it really? There's also other options there. There's so many interesting ways that developing countries work around the technical disadvantages that they might have. We have things like mesh networks coming up in Africa and all these kinds of things that might actually be potentially more interesting than the current client-server model that is still so dominant on the internet. The idea that we get the internet becomes more distributed rather than more centralized. That I think is what we, for instance, could learn from developing countries.
You've identified a fundamental distinction here, where a lot of times when we talk about online education, people will write an article saying, look, MIT is putting all of its courses online. How exciting, because now people, just like you said, now people in Africa can access MIT. But you've identified essentially that is perpetuating the traditional education system in some ways, because you're still relying on the brand of the education material, of the authority, the stamp of approval.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You see in the internet with big data and in fields all over the place, but I guess less so in education, the ability to learn from data, the machine learning from these large data sets. And I guess what you're saying is that could be a really great thing in education, essentially the same two-sided relationship we see with gig platforms, where you can review the service provider reviews the person who gets the service. All of that feedback culture, that two-sided system, that could be something revolutionary in education if we have a cultural shift in how we think about what it means to be an expert, what it means to have an education. And there might not just be a simple policy solution here, like flipping a switch or rewriting a law. It might require just people to really speak out about this, for the government to just set broad policies saying, like, we believe in the idea of, you know, two-sided education or whatever. It could just be a deliberate decision by individuals to change the way they think about education rather than here's a new law that'll fix everything.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, but it's, there's no silver bullet in education. Education is so personal. Learning is so personal. I mean, that's also what makes my work difficult, because every person you talk to has an opinion about education, and they're all right, because it's very personal. It's very, very, central to what it makes to be human and what it makes. But that doesn't mean that you cannot say things about it that you want to change. And I think, you really truly believe that. But I think, yeah, the fact that we at the moment lose a lot of knowledge and a lot of skills and a lot of talented people, just basically on the fact that they cannot get in the right places, I would say anyone that thinks rationally would find that a problem. And I think acknowledging the problem and then I think saying, like, okay, so what do we do with this waste of resource in education? Yeah, because we spend a lot of money on education. I mean, you in the US do it directly through by paying like a huge tuition fee. We do it through taxes, but that doesn't make it cheaper. I mean, the fact that we have an indirect system of funding our education doesn't mean it's cheap. Education is very expensive. And then I say that also self-critically as a former teacher and also someone who has been in the system for a long time and I've also been like a policymaker in that respect. I think when you look at the amount of money that is spent on education and the results that we get from it, that we do very poorly. And that isn't an attack on individual teachers, because I know they are like hardworking people. I think they do the best with the means that they have. But I don't think if you look at the way the money is spent, we do it in an optimal way.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with that. I mean, when you just look at the sheer amount of money that's spent. But hey, I mean, online education is certainly, it's already here.
Yeah.
It is changing all the time, and there are different models, and there's, you know, as you say, no one size fits all. And it's certainly something we'll be tracking here on the podcast. And as we talked about at IGF, it is very early to say, you know, the commercial internet is only 20 years old, and the idea of educating people is thousands of years old, if not more. So, you know, we'll have to just look at this issue and see how it develops. And we'll look to see how policymakers react, whether they're going to double down on the old system and the old model, or whether they will embrace disruption. But we'll leave it there.
But I was just thinking of one question when you were summing it up, and it was basically, what is the big, if you look at it the other way around, I've been to the US quite a lot and I know a little bit about the system, but I cannot say it from the inside. What would you say is at the moment the biggest threat to your education model?
Cost. But yeah, I would say that just the fact that, you know, people are making decisions about whether to have kids, mm-hmm. whether to buy a home, and then also having to factor in whether they can afford to educate their children. I would say that that's the biggest problem. And then secondly, I would say access to the internet. If you are both stuck in a high cost structure and you cannot circumvent the high cost structure using the internet, then that's a major problem. So, I mean, just that's my opinion. That's not something we don't have official positions at Tech Freedom on online education yet. But me personally, I think that those are the two big barriers right now. And then I would say accreditation is definitely an issue. I mean, we need to figure out ways of certifying people's skills that do not require expensive four-year degrees. There's got to be other ways to validate people's skills and to let them into markets and jobs without them having to go through traditional means, which might not actually be helpful. We might be asking people to take a break from their coding so that they can learn something that they're never going to use just because that's the traditional model. So there's a lot of ways that we can rethink what we're doing.
And it's so interesting how that accreditation argument comes up over and over again, because in how many cases, in other cases, just thinking out loud, would you accept the government to make that distinction for you if something is quality or not? If we go to a restaurant, do we first check if they were approved by the the board for what's it called, hygiene and whatever. No, we assume that they have that accreditation. If we look at the taxi market, we actually saw that it's improved since the accreditation isn't any that important anymore by Uber and that kind of things. If we look at healthcare, you want your doctor to have a certain degree, but it's not that that the best doctor is the one that was awarded by the government. Like, hey, so there are so many ways of like basically testing and approving, and we have so much richer data at the moment. We could have so much richer data at the moment that it's puzzling to me that when we talk about education, then we say like, no, of course the government should say this and this are the qualifications that you should have be to become. No, let's something that is less critical than a doctor, because then everyone thinks, yeah, of course you have to, but like to become an accountant. It's crazy. Why should the government decide what an accountant needs or what level you need for this and that? And why can't people, it's like it's making people dumb, and it's deliberate. And I think there are so many intelligent ways how to solve that. And I think the current model is so old fashioned, but somehow it's stuck in people's head. It's all about accreditation. Whereas I wouldn't care less if someone that I hire has a degree, if he knows what he's doing, and I can tell by the way he talks about it, what he does, and so on and so forth. I would be very happy to hire him, even if he slept under a rock for 40 years, if you know what I mean.
You're certainly not sitting idly by and watching this unfold. You are actively doing something. And people can go check it out. It's offcourse.io. Check it out. See what you can learn. See how you like the platform. And maybe it'll land you a new job someday. And then you can thank my excellent guest, Jan Hein Ogstad. I hope I didn't butcher that yet again, as I did in the intro.
It was even better than the first time.
Oh, fantastic. I'm already learning. Founder and technology developer. And thanks so much for the discussion today. This was really interesting.
Yeah, thank you. For just one comment, we're in private beta right now, but people can sign up, and we hope to become we hope to be public in a month from now. So just sign up for the beta, and we will prioritize everything.
I'm sure people will be excited to see when that launches. But that's it for today. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review, because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much, Evan.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.